Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Tim Wise, anti-racism educator and author, who examines the Trump administration's undisguised effort to eviscerate historic victories of the U.S. civil rights movement and turn back the clock to the Jim Crow era. Dr. Nader Hashemi, director of the Al-Waleed Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding at Georgetown University, who talks about the Trump administration's abduction of international students and the suppression of free speech on campus. And Maggie Mitchell-Solom, executive director of the Iris Refugee Agency in Connecticut, who discusses Trump regime actions that have resulted in dislocating thousands of immigrants, aid worker layoffs, and office closures. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Hundreds of thousands of opposition demonstrators marched through the streets of Belgrade, Serbia on March 15th to protest corruption they say is rampant in the regime of Serbian President Aleksandar Vučić. Student protests erupted last November after the collapse of a newly built concrete canopy at a rail station, killing 15 people. Students blamed the deadly accident on shoddy work by contractors linked to the regime. Since the accident, student-led protests with support from farmers, teachers, and lawyers have been organized every weekend. The Christian Science Monitor observed that the collapse of the rail station put a spotlight on graft in Serbia, putting President Vučić, who has close ties to the Kremlin, on the defensive. The students' core demands are that all documents for the construction of the ill-fated rail station be made public and for the government to increase the education budget by 20%, demands that have not yet been met. President Vučić has been unable to repress growing protests as they spread to over 200 municipalities, including small towns once loyal to the Vučić government. The Apple computer company is being sued by the Democratic Republic of the Congo as M23 rebels supported by neighboring Rwanda advance their offensive in the east of the country. The Congo filed criminal complaints against Apple subsidiaries in France and Belgium in December, alleging that the U.S. tech giant used laundered minerals that were smuggled into Rwanda from conflict areas in the DRC. The Congo is a major source of key rare earth minerals used in the world's computers and smartphones. More than 8,500 people have been killed in battles between M23 rebels and the Congolese army since fighting escalated in January. According to Foreign Policy magazine, Rwanda has few deposits of valuable minerals, yet exports vast amounts of coltan, most of which the United Nations says has been illegally smuggled from mines in the Congo seized by M23 last April. While French prosecutors dismissed the DRC's case last month, Belgium launched its own criminal investigation into the charges in January. A UN report published in December accused M23 of smuggling minerals to Rwanda and obscuring the shipments by mixing them with minerals from Rwandan production. Just weeks after devastating wildfires destroyed entire neighborhoods in greater Los Angeles, staff layoffs and a hiring freeze imposed by President Trump and Elon Musk have gutted the ranks of firefighters and support personnel. Fire prevention professionals warn that the loss of thousands of firefighters will leave many communities vulnerable, without critical resources they need to combat deadly wildfires when they arrive this summer. Veteran U.S. Forest Service firefighter and union official Stephen Gutierrez told Stateline News Service, "There's going to be firefighters that die because of this, and there will be communities that burn." Across the western U.S., state governments, local fire chiefs, and indigenous tribes rely on federal funds and the Forest Service for support and training in advance of the fire season. Now, with the Trump-Musk layoffs and budget cuts, fire prevention managers are preparing for the worst. Although the Inflation Reduction Act and infrastructure law passed under President Joe Biden made significant investments in projects to prevent out-of-control megafires, Trump is now attempting to block those grants. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Since Donald Trump returned to the White House in January, in the view of many observers, he's executed an explicitly white supremacist agenda. In just 10 weeks, Trump and his regime have outlawed DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion programs in the federal government, and threatened to withhold funding from states, private companies, and universities if they don't also end diversity initiatives. Trump's revocation of President Lyndon Johnson's 1965 executive order that prohibited government contractors from engaging in discriminatory hiring practices and segregation in the workplace was a blatant attempt to legalize the bigotry outlawed by the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Trump and his cabinet members have also expunged historical descriptions of achievements made by blacks, Latinos, women, Asians, LGBTQ and Native Americans from the Pentagon, Arlington National Cemetery, and Kennedy Center websites. Smithsonian museums are the target of a similar effort to censor or eliminate exhibits dedicated to recounting the history of people of color. At the same time, the Trump regime is working to restore statues dedicated to Confederate generals and renaming U.S. military bases after treasonous Confederate leaders. Donald Trump has ordered the government to limit or avoid the use of hundreds of words in documents and communications that include bias, racism, diversity, discrimination, activism, disability, climate crisis, hate speech, and cultural heritage. Your reporter spoke with Tim Wise, one of America's most prominent anti-racism educators, a critical race theorist and author, who serves as senior fellow at the African American Policy Forum. Here he describes the Trump administration's undisguised effort to eviscerate the historic victories of the civil rights movement and turn the clock back to the Jim Crow era.
Really, this administration is dead set on repealing really the 20th century and the first, you know, two decades or so of the 21st. And a big part of that, a huge part of that, I would say the largest part of that, is their hostility to the social reforms and progressive reforms specifically related to race, but also related to gender, that have taken place over the course of that 100 years. So the very same people that are attacking those DEI programs or any discussion or mention of the history of racism historically, let alone in the present, are the same people who are also attacking equity opportunities or reproductive freedom for women, the very same people who were engaged in this sort of manosphere thing, appealing to some of the most base elements of the most retrograde forms of so-called masculinity. There's an overlap, of course, with the attack on LGBTQ folks. All of this is of a piece. I think what folks have forgotten for a very long time, when we talk about left and right in America, we have fallen for this ploy that to be on the left is, oh, you believe in big government, and to be on the right is you believe in small government and individual freedom. Well, that's not ever been true, but it's obviously not true here. Here you have a right-wing government that believes in some of the most obvious intrusive forms of government, snatching people off the street and renditioning them to foreign prisons on suspicion of crimes for which you have no evidence, or at least are unwilling to present any evidence. This is an administration that wants to impose massive tariffs on trade. That is obviously not a typical a free market answer that conservatives would normally believe in. It's a big government intervention, whether you believe in it or not. It's big government. You know, this is an administration that is blown up the lie that the difference between left and right is about individual freedom versus big government. It is what it has always been ever since those terms began to be used during and after the French Revolution. The terms referred on the left, on the right, to people who wanted to preserve existing hierarchies of power and defend them, and the left wanting to upend and change those conditions of inequality. That's what this is. And so this is an administration that is committed to the restoration of traditional hierarchy, which they believe has been diminished far too substantially for their comfort. And so it's about restoring, obviously, the power of the rich, no doubt about that, but not just the rich. It is about restoring the power of whites, and not just whites, but white men, and not just white men, but straight white men and Christians, right? Every one of the identity-based hierarchies. They want to restore who they believe to be the rightful rulers in all of those categories. And that, of course, is straight, Christian, rich, white men above all, with some exceptions made perhaps for certain white women like Linda McMahon because she's rich too. Fundamentally, that's what this is an example of. And it just goes to demonstrate how you cannot understand American politics, the race piece in particular. You cannot understand anything that the right does without an understanding of the history of anti-blackness, the history of racism and white supremacy. And I know there are consultants in the Democratic Party, and then there are actual leftists who get mad when I say that. They get very upset. They accuse us of identity politics, and they say we should just talk about class and talk about the working class in particular in sort of a general way. But the attack on the working class in this country has historically been indelibly linked to the attack on black and brown people.
We're speaking with Tim Weiss, anti-racism educator, author, critical race theorist, and senior fellow at the African American Policy Forum. In responding to Trump's white supremacist agenda, is it time for an aggressive, energized 21st century new civil rights movement?
It absolutely is. And one that understands and learns from our past, but understands that there have always been people all through this country's history who have supported racial equity and racial justice. It is not a fringe issue. It is central. And in fact, if we're going to preserve democracy, we have to understand racism has always been the Achilles heel of American democracy. So if we're going to get democracy, we have to do that through civil rights and racial justice.
That was Tim Weiss, one of America's most prominent anti-racism educators, who serves as senior fellow at the African American Policy Forum. He's the author of 9 books, his latest titled Dispatches from the Race War. Find links to his website and writing by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In recent weeks, the nation has witnessed the Trump administration revoke visas and green cards from international students under the guise of protecting U.S. foreign policy and national security with the intention of deporting them. The reasons, sometimes cited, sometimes not, include unsupported accusations that these students had engaged in anti-Semitic activity during Gaza War campus protests last spring. The first student that was abducted by ICE agents on March 8th was Palestinian Columbia University graduate student and green card holder Mahmoud Khalil. Other students and instructors detained by ICE include Romesa Ozturk of Tufts University, Yunseo Chung, and Ranjani Srinivasan of Columbia, Ali Reza Darudi of the University of Alabama, Dr. Rasha Alawiya of Brown University, Mamadou Tal of Cornell, and Professor Badr Khan Suri of Georgetown University. Some student deportations have been halted by federal judges. Secretary of State Marco Rubio stated that he'd signed more than 300 letters revoking the visas of students, visitors, and others to force their expulsion from the U.S. because of their foreign policy views. Many believe the Trump regime's suppression of free speech, weaponizing the issue of Israel's bloody war in Gaza that's now killed more than 50,000 Palestinian civilians, and conflating any criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism, is designed to intimidate students and universities into silencing all dissenting views. Your reporter spoke with Dr. Nader Hashemi, director of the Al-Waleed Center for Muslim Christian Understanding at Georgetown University. Here, Dr. Hashemi, who served as the now-detained postdoctoral fellow, Badr Khan Suri's academic supervisor, talks about what he says are false charges ICE has leveled against Khan Suri, and his concern that university administrators are surrendering to Trump regime demands stemming from their failure to unify in resisting the government's targeting of free speech on campus.
Almost exactly 2 weeks ago, around 8 o'clock in the evening, federal agents showed up at Badr Khan Suri's home close to Georgetown in Arlington, Virginia. He's a postdoctoral fellow. He's an Indian national. He works on sort of peace-building themes, reconstruction, but specifically he is teaching a course for us right now at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown on the question of minority rights and majoritarianism in his native India. He's married to a Palestinian from Gaza, and his father-in-law 10 years ago was an advisor to the Palestinian prime minister who's from Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, who was assassinated by the Israelis in Tehran over the summer. And it seems like he was arrested because he was, so to speak, low-hanging fruit. He is on a visa. His wife is an American citizen. I think his wife was very much the target. But I think the bigger target here that ties the case of Badr Khan Suri with all of the other cases that you've mentioned on other university campuses is really an attempt by the Trump administration to spread fear and to intimidate students who roughly a year ago rose up in one of the great social protest movements in modern American history to oppose a U.S.-backed genocide in Gaza. And so he was arrested. Now he's in a detention facility, the last we heard, in Texas. He's done absolutely nothing wrong. He hasn't broken any laws. The interesting thing about his case, in contrast to Mahmoud Khalil's case at Columbia, which is better known, is that my colleague Badr Khan Suri was not a political activist, an organizer, or even a public intellectual. He just kept his head down, did his work, focused on his teaching. But he was targeted, I think, because he was easy to target because they couldn't get his wife, who I said is an American citizen, but also part of this broader campaign to spread fear and intimidation throughout university campuses to stop speaking out on Gaza. And it seems to be working because, you know, the reports that we're having right now on campus is that a lot of students, especially international students, are living in fear. They don't know if they're going to be next. That's the broad picture. I would add also that students who actually have done absolutely nothing, who haven't even participated in one protest. There is the case of this PhD student at the University of Alabama, a young man by the name of Ali Reza Duludi, who's a PhD student in mechanical engineering. It's unclear why he was arrested. He wasn't known to have participated in any protests, but it seems like the only reason why he was arrested was because he holds an Iranian passport. From the perspective of the Trump administration, that's good enough for you to get picked up and thrown into an ICE detention facility today.
Dr. Hashemi, what's been the response of the university, the students, the faculty, and the administrators to what happened at Georgetown with Khan Suri?
Well, a lot of outrage, anger. There was an immediate attempt to mobilize to provide support to the family. We had a protest last week. More protests are planned. The university, I think, privately has been supportive. Publicly, they're very cautious. Like other universities that have been targeted, they are trying to sort of play it very cautiously because they don't want to be the next Columbia. News just broke. Harvard has been subjected to the same type of Columbia-like treatment over the weekend. The Center for Middle East Studies at Harvard had its senior administrative staff, you know, really good scholars, people who do good work. They were suddenly fired from their jobs. Accusations of anti-Semitism were made against them. So universities, including mine, are trying to play it carefully because they don't want to be targeted. And I think this is part of the problem because, you know, one by one, these universities can be plucked off. But if there was some sort of united stand among most universities and colleges, and there was a willingness to stand up for, you know, the independence and the integrity of the American university system, then I think there would be a fighting chance to push back. And I think this is precisely why, you know, Trump is targeting our universities, because our universities are independent. They are places where people can think critically, where they can mobilize, where they can hold power accountable. And every authoritarian regime that tries to come to power targets those independent institutions that can hold them or try to hold government officials accountable. So it's not a, you know, fluke that universities are being targeted in this way. This is right out of the authoritarian playbook. Anyone who studies authoritarian transitions can see what happened in Viktor Orban's Hungary or Erdogan's Turkey or in, you know, Putin's Russia, happening right now in the United States. This is not a passing phenomenon. This is a major transition toward authoritarianism, and it really requires everyone to sort of stand up, organize, and try and fight back, because if we don't, we're going to find ourselves living in a very dark authoritarian regime very soon.
That was Dr. Nader Hashemi, director of the Al-Waleed Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding at Georgetown University. Find more analysis and commentary on the Trump administration's attempt to suppress student free speech by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. From his first days in office, Donald Trump took steps to prevent undocumented immigrants and refugees from entering the country. But he's also targeted entirely different groups of people who have temporary protected status. In late January, he froze all federal funding to assist refugees resettling in the U.S. He also prohibited all refugees from entering the country, even those who had already been thoroughly vetted and approved, some of whom had already purchased airline tickets. On March 25th, the Ninth Circuit Court partially granted and partially denied the government's motion to overrule another federal court's initial preliminary injunction issued in a case that ruled that the administration's indefinite refugee ban and funding freeze were illegal. The latest circuit court ruling said that Trump can enforce a ban on some refugee admissions, but also stipulated that the administration must honor resettlement of all refugees whose status was conditionally approved before Trump took office. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Maggie Mitchell-Solom, Executive Director of Integrated Refugee and Immigrant Services of Connecticut, or IRIS. The Trump regime has thus far withheld $3 million already authorized for IRIS to provide services, resulting in the layoff of 20% of their staff and the closure of their main office building. Here, Solom discusses the pros and cons of the latest court ruling on refugee admission status and the Trump administration's response.
You know, we're incredibly hopeful because of the ongoing rulings against the administration's actions in suspending the U.S. refugee admissions program, which has actually been upheld, the suspension, except for this carve-out for those that are already vetted and were ready to travel. You know, while that raises our hope, the admissions program might at least be restarted to resettle those individuals who have been waiting for years to get into the United States and have gone through the most extreme vetting there is. That said, there are two things that give me pause. One is that in Placito versus Trump, which IRIS's National Resettlement Agency, Church World Service, is a plaintiff in that suit. In that case, the administration in one of the filings indicated that they plan to create a different way of resettling refugees when they do decide to resume, and that there would be one national agency that would be administering the resettlement program. So that's one thing that gives me pause. The second is that the Trump administration, in one of the most recent court cases, has been instructed to allow in the 100,000 already vetted refugees. The top five countries that the U.S. accepts refugees from are Rohingya from Burma or Myanmar, Sudan, Syria, Venezuela, and Afghanistan. Four out of those five countries are on the travel ban red list, meaning that they may not be able to, in fact, would be very unlikely to be able to reach the U.S. once that travel ban goes into effect. And so that's pretty devastating. So it's one of the many reasons that I do not think that even with this judgment, which is significant, that it is going to have any real impact. Another problem is that the entire resettlement system from overseas processing to domestic reception has atrophied in the past 3 months because of the stop work orders and because the administration has not until recently even resumed funding that they were ordered to resume over a month ago. So that's the state of play in terms of the court case that looks hopeful for at least a temporary resumption of the current U.S. refugee admissions program. But I just think the proof is in the administration's inaction.
Maggie Mitchell-Solom, I think the situation of the Afghans, many of whom work directly in support of the U.S. occupation of their country, is especially sad if they are going to be excluded. Do you think there's a chance that some of them will get in?
There are groups that are working really, really hard. Afghan Evac, No One Left Behind, among others, and veterans groups are trying to press the administration to create a carve-out for Afghan allies, for those Afghans who helped support U.S. forces during the more than two decades that we were in Afghanistan. It is unclear at this time whether that carve-out is part of the recommendations that the State Department is putting forward to the White House. And then even if it were, whether the White House would agree and accept that carve out. And then there are other Afghans who come here as humanitarian parolees who are also in jeopardy. And the Afghans that come here as humanitarian parolees, some of them worked for the Afghan national government, which was an ally of the United States. And the entire humanitarian parole program is at risk right now, starting with the Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans who are losing their status on April 24th.
Your funding was cut by $3 million, and you've had to significantly downsize your operations. So if people do make it to Connecticut, are you going to be able to help them?
We are helping those Afghans who are able to come here. Some funding that supports them is still online, and we're able to use that. And then there has just been incredible support from the community sponsor groups, groups across the state of Connecticut that have helped sponsor refugees and Afghan allies in the past. They are stepping up now and helping us support these families. And we were so glad that the travel ban has not been implemented yet. We were expecting it 2 weeks ago, and we hold our breath, as do hundreds of thousands of people around the world, for that to come into place. So, you know, each arrival is pure joy.
That was Maggie Mitchell-Solom, Executive Director of Integrated Refugee and Immigrant Services of Connecticut, or IRIS. Learn more about IRIS and the plight of refugees dislocated by Trump's executive orders by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WMBR in Cambridge, Massachusetts, KKFI in Kansas City, Missouri, KMUD in Garberville, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.